after we finished recording, there was a tragic footnote at the end of a celebratory weekend for Denmark and the Tour de France, with reports of a shooting in Copenhagen in which several people apparently lost their lives. I wanted to make clear that this episode was recorded before we were aware of the incident, so that people don't feel the tone of our coverage of the cycling was in any way inappropriate. Our thoughts are with everyone affected by the incident.
You are listening to the Tour des Flâneurs, the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien, energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Stage 3, today we are in Sønderborg.
Well, where are we, Mitch?
Well, we're downtown Sønderborg, but more importantly, we're at Café Marcello, a place that, amazingly, they've got... I walked in, I saw the beers on tap. They asked me, what beer do you want? I think it was a bit of a joke. I walked across there, I was, oh, it's about 10 beers on tap here, great. And they said, by the way, we've only got Grimbergen. I was like, what's going on here? Don't tell me you've sold out of all your beers. They said, we've sold out of all our beers. I said, what? They said, it's the Tour de France. I have never heard of a place that's sold out of all their beers, their kegs, and they've got one beer left, Grimbergen. So I ordered 3 Grimbergens.
Well, at least they had enough for 3 Grimbergens.
Yes.
That's a real relief. We are in Sønderborg at the end of our 3-day stay in Denmark. It's been fantastic, hasn't it? And I'll certainly be sad to go. Stage 3... Well, a sprint finish as we expected, but really it was the Magnus Cort stage, wasn't it? Because the Danish rider in the King of the Mountains jersey, he got all of the points yesterday, he got all of the points again today, he was up the road on his own, minutes ahead of the peloton, enjoying, milking every last moment out of his experience. He'll no doubt remember that for the rest of his life, but he did, once he had all of those points in the bag, he allowed the peloton to catch up with around 53 kilometres to go. And then it was a fairly controlled run until 11 kilometres to go, actually, when there was a section of cobbles as they were coming through a slightly urban area. A little bit of spit of rain in the air at that point. That crash split the bunch. All of the main sprinters made it into the first part, but there was only about 60, 70, maybe 80 riders in that first group at that point. And then came the sprint finish. They came right round that left-hand bend. And as we'll discuss, that was where Fabio Jakobsen lost touch with Mikael Merku, his lead-out man extraordinaire. And that's what cost Jakobsen the chance to win 2 out of 2. And it was Dylan Groenewegen, the Dutchman, bike exchange rider, riding his first Tour de France since 2019. His 5th Tour de France stage win. He was first over the line ahead of Wout van Aert, the yellow jersey. Jasper Philipsen was 3rd for Alpecin de Koenig. Peter Sagan, maybe the green shoots of a return to sprinting form for Sagan. He was 4th. Jakobsen in 5th. There were quite a lot of riders who lost some time. A split and 39 seconds separated Rigoberto Urán. Jack Haig of Bahrain victorious. Disappointing to lose 39 seconds on a fairly routine day. He was in that group. But then some of the other riders in there, quality riders, Guillaume Martin, Chris Froome, Bauke Mollema, Mike Woods, Thibaut Pinot. I mean, that might well be the beginning of a strategic losing of time so that they can maybe get out on the attack as the race reaches the mountains towards the end of the week. Wout van Aert still in yellow, but now 7 seconds ahead of Yves Lampaert. Tadej Pogacar is at 14 seconds. Mads Pedersen is still 4th. Filippo Ganna, one of the riders to slip right down the classification today. And tonight, the race leaves Denmark and returns back to Lille. Before we move on, the big reveal of the 3 MAP jerseys, the cycling podcast and MAP, we're collaborating this year, and the brief for MAP's designer was to come up with some designs that would look good on a cycling podcast pro team through the ages. And we've been revealing these jerseys on social media over the last 3 days, and today the 3rd design, Fade, was made public. It's kind of Well, it fades from white into a bright raspberry ripple pink and then into a fluorescent yellow, very reminiscent of the early 90s, almost overtones of the acid house scene, the British acid house scene of the early 90s, perhaps. And when I first saw the designs, Francois, that was my out-and-out favourite. But now I've seen the actual jersey on the back of a real rider in photographs, it's a lot closer, and I'm leaning towards the 1980s one. But your view on the acid house fade?
I think it's a generation problem. For me, the 60s will always be the best period for everything. So, and especially for design, and especially for looks. I mean, you know, people never looked as good as they did in the 60s. So I can see that you have a little bit of nostalgia for the days when you went dancing all night, you know, while taking drugs I don't want to hear about. But it's those days are gone, you know.
So
I stick to my original idea.
Scarless.
I mean, let's face it. I like the mape, the kind of mape one, because it just looks like the mape one, but it's something else. I must say, I've always liked all kinds of music. I've been trying to be young and you know, connected for most of my life, but the acid scene has not really been mine.
I should stress, I've never tested positive, Francois, and that's a scurrilous rumour. Extraordinary accusations require extraordinary proof. But you can all vote if you want to for your favourite at map.cc, and the winner will go into production and will have a little buffalo motif added to it to remember our friend Richard Moore. But which is your favourite? Check, dot, or fade? Go to map.cc to vote.
Check.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2022 Tour de France, powered by Super Sapien. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. Still guessing on fueling? Not sure what or when to eat and drink on rides that matter? Never again. Optimize your fueling strategy with real-time glucose data, actionable insight, and personalized analytics. We are here to help you achieve your performance goals. Go to supersapiens.com for more on how to track your energy levels and fuel for success.
Thank you very much to Super Sapiens. We've been mentioning the Super Sapiens podcast, which you can find in all good podcast apps. And this is a little taste of the recent episode, which features the triathlete Eloise Deluart.
I did a bit of self-research again, very dangerous. Didn't talk to the people I should have, like my coaches. And I came across the phenomenon that if you're lighter, you're faster. Really focused on this, started getting some results. I was like, oh, I got a bit faster. I didn't read the small print. There wasn't that asterisk that said this happens to a point and then you'll fall off a cliff and have massive issues, quite literally. And essentially, I just became obsessed with it, which amongst my sort of perfectionism, amongst my sort of willing to always do more and be better and not seeing who I am in that moment, is essentially I developed an eating disorder. So any belief that I had that I would be faster almost went, it suddenly became I had to be thinner. That was how I was going to get stronger.
Now on with the business. Mitch, as a lead out man and a sprinter from your pro days, what did you make of the finish and Dylan Groenewegen's win?
Well, he really looked out of it, actually, at about 2K to go. He was a long way back. And actually, speaking with some of the riders, they were a little bit worried. Luka Mezjek opened the gap up for him. And it was just by coincidence that Armin Jensen, he came past with a lot of speed that brought him back into the race. But he still had to do quite a lot of work from that point. And, you know, it all looks perfect now. But as he went around that corner, Armin Jensen got him into that final corner. And he did quite a lot of work from there. He was only a couple of wheels in front of Jakobsen, actually, at that point. But a couple of wheels, crucial wheels in front of him. But again, he showed that determination that he's obviously got bottled up inside of him. And he made his way through, clearly got the speed as well. One thing I noticed from Michael Morkov was something I didn't expect him to do was not being aware that he'd lost Jakobsen, yeah. Something that he's normally very, very good at.
Yeah.
And to see him doing the lead out essentially for Jumbo was really uncharacteristic for him, because normally he's really aware of that stuff. And what he would have normally have done was, it's not in my wheel, I'm on the front, time for me to move out of the way and expose Jumbo early and make them take on the lead out. Instead, he actually did a beautiful lead out for Wout van Aert.
Yeah, I was about to ask you the question. What did Michael Merkel for once? What did he do? And in that case, you know, when you've been the lead out man, if you're speeding, you're in a sprint, and you realize your sprinter is not there, shouldn't you sprint on? You know, like you see Christophe Laporte who led out Wout van Aert, finished sixth. So I guess, do you think that Merkel, realizing Jakobsen was not there, shouldn't have tried to, you know, for what is worth, to go on
for minor places?
Too far out as well, wasn't it?
Too far
out,
but I mean, it could have made it top five, maybe.
I think, look, as my personal, you're so bought into your job, and the best thing you can do as a lead out man is to swallow your pride and move out of the way, because you don't know if your sprinter is actually slotted in three wheels back. If he's slotted in three wheels back, that means you're most going to have to open up their sprint early, which ultimately means they're going to lead out your sprinter, the job that you were supposed to do. If you start leading it out, you're then making it easier for the other guys to win. So you've got to really pocket your own ego there, move out of the way, and expose the other teams.
Another impact that might have had on the race, that Michael Merkel move, is that it seemed that Caleb Ewan, Wout van Aert, Peter Sagan got kind of boxing together on the right end of the road, and Merkel, you know, getting out of the way, kind of opened the way for Groenewegen to come back and win. So there was an opening that all of a sudden appeared, while the other were all battling out on the right hand side of the road, and maybe there was a moment when Groenewegen could, you know, make his way back.
It is funny when you watch those things from the top there, and you can really see how, you know, afterwards, if this had happened, if that had happened, I agree. And I think one thing too, to go back on Michael and other lead out men, is the mentality too. You got to remember that you are a lead out man, and you don't have, the reason why you're a lead out man is, one, you're physically capable of doing that, but two, you don't have the mentality of a sprinter. Sprinters have a really, really different mentality. Killer instinct, I like to say. White line fever. You see these guys do amazing things, and weirdly, when you get thrown the reins to go and have a sprint for yourself as a lead out man, you don't have it. You really get quickly reminded why you're not a winner.
Mikael Merkel did hold his hands up in all the interviews after the finish line. I spoke to him at the finish, and he said he made a mistake, a rare mistake for him, I would say, but he made a mistake not to check up. They came around the corner that Jakobsen was still on the wheel, and he carried on with the full effort to do the lead out. Jakobsen lost the wheel on that left-hand turn, didn't he, and slipped back a few places. And I guess when Merkel pulled over to the left side, once he'd noticed that Jakobsen wasn't there, I suppose there's always a fleeting chance that Jakobsen might be sort of nestled in there somewhere, and they can recouple up and go again. But it didn't work out that way. I thought, for what it's worth, Jakobsen did pretty well to coast over the line in fifth place. But the day belonged to Dylan Groenewegen, and I think that these 2 days, there's a really quite a nice symmetry, isn't there? Because that incident at the Tour of Poland, which I do keep mentioning and I don't want to kind of dwell on, but it was horrific for both riders in two very different ways. Jakobsen sustained all of the injuries and had the comeback, but Groenewegen was really publicly vilified for his role in that crash. He took all of the responsibility for it, and he's had a different journey back to this point. You know, the psychological aspect of sprinting, you know, they are all trusting one another that they're not going to do anything that jeopardizes themselves or each other. And so I think symbolically, for Jakobsen to win yesterday and Groenewegen to win today, you can almost, I will draw a line under it from mentioning it every time they sprint head to head. But it did feel like a sort of a bit of a moment to have those two riders winning on consecutive days. I don't know what you thought, Mitch.
I also thought that I didn't want to draw that line, that, you know, it is sort of really nice to see them both back and almost like bygones be bygones, let's race. They're just back racing, the two best sprinters of the new generation, actually. And they got set back for a couple of years, both of them, as you just stated, for two slightly different comebacks. But it's great to see, in my eyes anyway, I'm going to put my sprinter hat on here, good quality sprints again. And I'm actually happy to see Sagan back up there. mixing it up. More sprinters back up there, making it unpredictable for us. Caleb Ewan, who I thought was going to be, you know, really pushing the limits, hasn't had a good run the last couple of days. So he's another top-level sprinter of the new generation, as we all know, and he hasn't featured. So great stuff to come.
Yeah, what happened to Ewan? Because he looked like he was in a decent position on the wheels, but as Sagan was moving across to the right, he had nowhere else to go, but he kind of left it too late. And as you said, while we were watching it, the door was closing as Ewan was making his move and the moment was gone.
I think Caleb also there's a bit of an adjustment at the moment to a new lead out train in the hardest race of the world. So it's very hard for him, even though he is a good guy to coast off other wheels. He's been used to being delivered very well in the recent years off, you know, Roger Kluger, the rest of the train there as well. And suddenly now, and nothing to take away from the guys who are doing the job, everyone's getting used to it. And they're getting used to each other in the Tour de France. So that's all adding to it.
Well, at the finish, we were at the Bike Exchange Team Barston Vehicles. All smiles, of course. They've come here looking for stage wins because they haven't got anyone for the overall. And they have really had to sort of busk together a bit of a freelance lead-out train, haven't they? Mitch, you spoke to Jack Bauer. So we'll hear from Jack Bauer and then from Matt White, the sports director, who was understandably delighted to get a win nice and early.
How was it, mate? Yeah. Unbelievable. I saw you pop him up. He was gone. He was out. And then suddenly...
It wasn't me.
Wasn't you?
Who brought him up? That was all Armand.
Oh, it was Armand.
Armand got him out into the wind, opened up on the right with about a K to go.
I saw that. I
managed to get him into a decent position to that corner.
And then he came around
the
corner.
From that point on, I think Jumbo had the right-hand side. And it was just a matter of whether Wout's going to open to the left and open the door. And obviously, eventually he did.
That is awesome. It's not only great for the team, but also for him personally, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he's had a difficult road back. I would struggle in the position that he's in to come back and win at the Tour again on a race of this level with the obvious competition is, I think it says a lot to his persona. We, of course, are very happy. We are very happy.
What about the crowds finally? Like, does that just add to it? Yeah. You know, just that feeling the whole day where you're sort of like just...
Back to the, the London Games.
Yeah.
Harrogate Tour 2014. I've never seen crowds like that since. This is almost on par.
Wow. That's
I think you'd probably agree, watching from the sidelines, it's been pretty amazing.
It's incredible. I wish I was out there, only just to experience the crowds, not the speed. But anyway, good to see you, mate. Thanks for that.
You too, bro.
It's fine margins in the sprints, isn't it? But what was the difference between today and yesterday?
Well, yesterday, what complicated yesterday was the headwind. You know, it was a different kind of final. Today was more of a pure sprint today. You know, yesterday at 3K to go, there was, 150 blokes trying to get into one corner at 3.5K to go. Today was a lot faster, which you know, not takes the luck out of things, but, you know, when the finishes are so fast... No, it's harder for guys who normally aren't there to get in the way. And that's yesterday was, as we saw, with those crashes on the bridge, going off the bridge. It was pretty messy yesterday. Today was a bit more of a cleaner, pure sprint.
Yeah, and you must be delighted that the whole team's bounced back after not quite pulling it off yesterday, not quite getting right up there in the mix yesterday.
Yeah, look, mate, you know how we roll. You know how we roll. It's, you know, you win some, you lose some. And we just had to stay focused on what we had planned to do. And that's, you know, we got... six opportunities to win here with Dylan, and we've been fortunate enough to nail number two.
I mean, on Dylan, what's his personality like these days? Because, of course, you know, that crash a couple of years ago with Jakobsen, he bore the brunt of the criticism for that, and he's had to also get himself back into the game and be able to sprint against the best in the world in the, you know, the pressure cooker atmosphere.
Yeah, and look, obviously Dylan's had hard times over the last couple of years. It hasn't been an easy journey back for him. But it just shows for him to be where he is at the moment, he's a tough cookie. And I'm really, really happy that we've been able to help him achieve what he had already achieved in the past, and that's be one of the fastest sprinters in the world.
I also spoke to one of the other key people in Bike Exchange's managerial lineup, Brent Copeland, about the decision to sign Dylan Groenewegen after he left Jumbo-Visma. I mean, he was under contract at Jumbo-Visma, but they came to an arrangement so that he could join the Bike Exchange team. And also how this win affects Bike Exchange in the relegation battle from the World Tour, because some crucial points secured today as Bike Exchange look to try and draw themselves away from that scrap for a World Tour place.
Brent, just on the decision to sign Dylan Groenewegen, because of course he took all of the criticism for the crash in Poland in 2020, and while Jakobsen's, you know, had to come back from all of the injuries, that crash must have affected Groenewegen as well, and so he's also had to make a journey back to competing at the highest level against the best riders in the world.
Yes, sure. I mean, it wasn't an easy journey for sure. I think the team has been fantastic in creating the correct environment for him to feel at home, feel at ease, and we went out of our way to create an environment which helped him, because we knew he was going through a difficult time. It was not easy for him of what happened. The reason for signing him up was we were looking for a pure sprinter from 2 years ago, and when we heard that Jumbo-Visma were not going to be taking him to the Tour de France and he wanted to go to the Tour, thanks to our partners Giant, we were put in contact with him. And the negotiation started there, and I started talking to Richard Pluch, and I must say that Richard was really a pleasant negotiation to do with him, because, you know, there was a transfer. He did have a contract with him. So it was an easy transfer. It was a pleasant transfer. It was a negotiation that went down easy. And then, of course, we had our team owner, Jerry Ryan, who was supporting it 100%. But we knew it wasn't going to be an immediate win. You know, it was going to take time. To build a train around a sprinter takes time. And I think the technical staff and Whitey and everyone else has done really good in getting him to where he's got to now. And this win means so much to him, and we're just so pleased for him, obviously for the team as well and all our partners, but especially for him. Because the way that, you know, he was made out to look like a criminal is completely opposite to what his real character is like. You know, his character's very different to that. He's a very sensitive person, and definitely not what he was made out to be. So for him to be able to do this now, I think means a lot to him personally, which is important.
And for the team, I mean, you say putting together a sprint train. I mean, Luka Mezcek is a key part of that, isn't he? But I mean, you've come into the race hunting for stages. How easy is it to put a kind of freelance train together, I guess, relatively short notice?
Yeah, it's not easy. And you know, we brought him on late, so we didn't have time to build a team around him and build a train around him, which is something we're looking at for the future. But we've found the right people of who we had in the team in order to build that train, and they've done a really great job. You can see the motivation in the guys. Yesterday was incredible, the work they did. Today was incredible, the work they did. And he's got riders like Michael Matthews, who's just, you know, it's a rider that wouldn't have to do that kind of work, but he's doing a great job. You've got Luka Mezcek and you've got Amund. So you put all of them together with Jack Bauer and the other engine room guys that we got, they're doing a fantastic job, and this was the outcome.
And lastly, the relegation battle that is everyone's talking about, but it's actually quite difficult to follow because the point system is, for the spectators, is quite hard to follow. How much has that been on your mind, and how important is a win like this in terms of just getting points to try and get away from the bottom of the table?
Yeah, it's a concern for everyone that's in that possible relegation area. It's part of the sport. We've just got to concentrate on our goals, and that's what we're doing. You know, we've got goals. We've got very important races coming up for the second part of the season. Winning a stage at the Tour de France is important, but there's other important races coming up, and we believe that with the riders we have on board, with the goals that we're aiming for, if we're able to reach those goals, I don't think we have much to concern about.
Do you know off the top of your head how many points that win is worth, and where you're lying in the table at the moment?
If I'm not mistaken, that's 125 points.
And are you in the drop zone at the moment, as they say in soccer?
Yes, we are. We're down there, but that makes part of a relegation system fun, isn't it? That's what they're trying to create, and it's making the teams race for one another, but it's just a pity that it's during a pandemic.
So go for another 125 points on Tuesday.
Absolutely, we will do that.
Well, Wout van Aert was second in the yellow jersey. Francois, have we cleared up this question from last night about when was the last time the yellow jersey was involved in a bunch sprint?
Well, a few listeners have been going hard at it and trying to find instances. It's very rare. obviously, you know. The only recollections I have, but it's not really bunch sprints, is guys like Hino winning on the Champs-Élysées. But could you call that bunch sprints? Or maybe one of the Hino wins might have been. But once again, no, it's very rare. And I mean, Wout van Aert once again proved it's difficult to win without a win with the yellow jersey, being second for the third day in a row, which is a feat in itself. A guy, remember, who collected second places in the bunch sprints in the Tour de France was Peter Sagan. And as you said, Mitch, I'm glad that the Jakobsen, Groenewegen, whatever it was, you want to call it, you know, incident is kind of over now because they're back to their best level. But I'm also glad to see Sagan back in the mix in sprints, because we kind of missed, you know, Sagan. And the reason why Sagan seems to maybe be not far from, you know, back to his best level was he looked, you know, dejected at the end of the sprint, whereas everything was regular. But he pointed, you know, towards Wout van Aert, like, you know, implying that maybe, he was boxing in an irregular fashion. And later on, you know, he talked to French TV and said, well, listen, I watched the replay and there was nothing, you know, everything was perfectly regular. But, you know, to see Sagan back in the gritty and really wanting to be part of the mix is good news, I think, for sprints and for cycling.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Babbel. Now, Francois, you're multilingual, at least bilingual. Do you speak any other languages other than French and English?
I understand Spanish pretty well. I speak a bit of Catalan because I live in Catalonia, you know, from time to time. And I understand Italian because it's not very different from French. I think that's it.
Well, that's not bad. That's not bad. The Babbel app will help you learn a language with some... It's almost like a game, really, because each level takes you on to the next level, and you can do it in a very short space of time. Each lesson takes around 15 minutes, and you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. And Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you improve your pronunciation and accent. So you can start language learning today with Babbel. All Cycling Podcast listeners can get a 6 months free subscription with the purchase of a 6 month subscription. So effectively, that's pay for 6 months and get 6 months free with the promo code cycling. So go to babbel.com/play and use the promo code cycling. That's babbel.com/play. Now, mentioning Seb Piquet, actually, I saw Seb this evening as he came into the press room area after sitting in the car all day, the voice of race radio doing his job. And he confirmed that on Wednesday morning in Lille, there will be a little ceremony for Richard Moore. So we'll all go there and see what Christian Prudhomme and co have to say to honour our friend Richard Moore. So we're absolutely... Well, we're delighted that the Tour de France have chosen to honour and recognise Richard. And we'll be there representing the cycling podcast. Now, on the way back from the team buses, Mitch, we saw Kate Wagner, who had a very interesting day. She was on the motorbike buzzing around the peloton, up the outside, seeing Magnus Cort in the break. And I wanted to find out from her how her day had gone.
I'm on the motorbike today. And we just pulled off at kilometer zero to watch them go for it, huh? Everyone, so many fans. I've never seen so many people at a bike race in my life. And honestly, it makes me a little bit emotional. And I can't wait to... Everyone waves at me on the bike. I feel like Princess Diana. So, great time. Very excited. See you soon. Ciao. Ida. Hello, Francois and Mitch and... Lionel. Sorry, turning it here. The atmosphere here is incredible. I'm sandwiched here in between the breakaway of Magnus Cort Nielsen and the peloton. We're taking the turns like quite swiftly, and it's amazing to see all of the people out. Truly, when I wave, everyone cheers. I feel like a celebrity, like I said before, huh? But anyways, check in soon. We're going slow. We're about to pass Magnus Cort. I'd give him an interview, but I think he's a little busy right now. Aida, ciao.
Well, Kate, you look windswept. You've been on the motorbike all day. What was it like?
It was incredible. I've never seen so many people in my life. I mean, you would go into these towns and people would just be stacked 5-6 rows from the side of the road. Unbelievable. And not only that, when you would suddenly turn a corner on the motorbike or on the course, and you would go to you would be just suddenly in the middle of nowhere, like total farmland. And then you'd go maybe, I don't know, a kilometer or so like that, and then suddenly more people, just where you don't even know where they come from. And every time there's a hill, they're stacked. It's like a sea of yellow and Danish flags. I mean, you wave to them and they all holler. I felt like Princess Diana on the motorbike. So it's not my first time. It's not my first time on the motorbike. So this time I was like prepared for the speed bumps, you know, because there's lots of things on the motorbike that are you get used to. By the end of it, you'll start texting on your phone while being on there. But the speed bumps are really, because you really feel like you're going to come right off. And I knew at the end of the course, when we got to the end of the course, that it was going to be quite technical for the riders. Because once you went over that bridge, you were basically kind of weaving in and out of town, and you would hit just patches of cobblestones, which I didn't realize were there. And they really are quite... So when I knew that was coming, I was like, oh, someone's going to crash there. And I'm watching on the screen as they're coming, and yeah, they did. But all in all, pleasurable experience. Highly recommend the motorbike. Thank you to my driver, Christophe. Thank you to the ASO for letting me be on the motorbike. Great time.
Does it give you, a renewed sense of appreciation? Because the more you watch on TV, the more kind of blasé you become about the way the riders move, just how close they are to each other, the level of kind of intuition that the riders have got. So being on the motorbike at their level, in amongst them almost, you really get a 3D vision of what the Tour de France is all about.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. You only get to go through the peloton one or two times because when you are press on the motorbike, you don't have TV rights, and so you are kind of lower on the pecking order. But when you do go through them, it really is quite incredible. Because this was a sprint stage, they were all quite relaxed. You weave through them on the motorbike, and you can hear their little conversations. And there were some talking, I think, about pizza or about Netflix or something like that. But that's how close you are to them. You can almost reach out and touch them. You don't want to because they'll probably fall over. But you are that close. And then you'll weave through them. You'll get to the front. And then you speed up and then you catch the breakaway. And this time the breakaway was only Magnus Cort. But it was incredible to see Magnus Cort many different times because every time he would pass through these small towns, he would always you could tell he was soaking it in. And they really, people were chanting like, Cort, 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 because they all knew he was coming. It was really quite moving. I bet it was one of the best days of his life.
Stage was it you went on the motorbike before?
That was the stage last year's Tour de France, the stage that Mohoric won, the second one, so 19. And that was quite interesting because on that stage we could see the composition of the breakaway change throughout the stage. That was one of the stages where it was quite interesting to follow the breakaway because you would see them arguing all the time because those breakaway guys like Mohoric, like De Gendt, they... Van der Horn, they all have to be very good talkers. They have to be able to persuade other people to let them stay in the breakaway. And you can kind of watch these negotiations in full time, real time. That was also an interesting day because this one was a little more, the terrain was more diverse. That was a really pan-flat stage. But in this stage, you really did go through quite a few towns. Wasn't really that rural. I mean, there were stretches that were rural. And then also you had these nice passages in the forest where you had these hills that were quite thrilling.
Did you get a sense? I mean, a relatively routine day for a lot of the riders. partly, I guess, because they've got the big transfer back to France tonight, which kind of impedes a little bit on the rest day routine.
Yeah, I definitely think that plays a factor into it. By the time we sped off to the finish, Magnus Cort was just about to be caught, and then at that point did you really start to see. So sort of after the last climb, did you start to see them really get organized? Because before it was almost like they were on a club ride, really relaxed, very chill. It'd be interesting to see how they behave on a stage that's more complicated, like the cobble stage, for example.
Any more intel you picked up from just keeping eyes on the peloton today?
Intel, let's see. I think that one thing that's really quite amazing to me is who is always on the front. And to me, every time we would pass through, like, Jumbo was always right there. And, like, everyone else would be quite relaxed, but they were quite tense and quite focused. So I think that they have many goals, and they're working really hard, it seems.
Is that in contrast to Pogacar?
Well, Pogacar, he always looks relaxed. You know, he could be, you know, trying to get rid of a bomb, and he would still be just, well, you know, okay. It's like, maybe it's the blue wire, maybe it's the green one, but it's okay, who knows, you know, what's the worst that can happen? He's really like that. And so he was kind of all smiles today when he would pass through. He's very, he doesn't worry about anything. It's actually, I think, his most remarkable quality.
I can hear a new nickname coming on. I don't know, the bomb diffuser or something.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for, diffuser. The bomb diffuser. But he's the one who drops the bombs, you know. He's like both diffuser and dropper.
Detonator. The detonator. Yeah. The detonator and the diffuser all in one. Fantastic.
Science in Sport is supporting the cycling podcast at the 2022 Tour de France. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport. You can get 25% off everything at scienceinsport.com with the discount code SISCP25. I always recommend the Tiramisu Energy Bakes. I haven't actually got any with me here. Wow, some singing at the next table there. I think we now know where all of the beer went, don't we, I think, if we look at some of the tables around us. So that's, 25% off at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Our three-day mini break in Denmark is coming to an end, and the logistics of getting back to France are quite complicated, aren't they? All three Grand Tours this year have these overseas starts. The Giro started in Hungary. We had 3 days there before transferring to Sicily, and the Vuelta will start in the Netherlands before going to Spain, and of course the Tour de France here in Denmark. And this presents a logistical challenge for the entire race. The teams, of course, but also the likes of us. We're taking planes, trains and automobiles to get back to France. Mitch, you and Francois are going on the official ASO flight tonight. You've got maybe not the golden ticket, but maybe the bronze ticket, because I think you're taking off at about midnight. Is that right,
we
Francois?
Are. Yeah, there's more than one plane, and ours is the very last one. We're supposed to take off at 5 past midnight, and we'll get to Lille at about 2 o'clock in the morning in Lille-Léquin, and then we have to find our own way to get to our hotel. And mind you, I made plans to take us to our beds in due course. But yeah, it's a logistical problem for us. But can you imagine what it is for the riders? I had my own logistics problem this morning and today. You know, we use little recorders to give you the best interviews we can get, and they're fueled by little SD cards, the same as you put on your like SIM cards you put in your telephones, and the SD card on which was the best two interviews I'd done in my life, one with Patrick Lefebvre and another one with Matt White. Well, the card actually snapped when I was trying to put it in my computer. So, well, you won't hear Patrick Lefebvre. You won't hear Matt White. You might hear one of our Danish friends because the lady singing just a minute ago has come to sit at our table. But, however, I can tell you all about what Patrick Lefebvre and what Matt White told me about the logistics, if you want. So let's make it simple. Teams have organized the coming back to France. They actually at the finish line today. They booked hotels to make sure the riders could relax and enjoy a little nap. And I'm saying it while under an intense pressure from the fans.
What a pro, Francois! This is extraordinary.
And then once the riders took their showers in the hotels, rushed to the planes. They rushed to the planes. I think the plane was 6:30, and towards Lille. And then there are two other flights for staff and journalists to get back to France as well. And the rest of the staff of the teams, like Matt White and the other guys, they were actually driving back. And the buses already drove all the way through Germany to France, and most of the other staff of the teams, they will be staying in Germany somewhere. I mean, Matt White and so the bike exchange team will be staying in Bremen. And the little thing about Patrick Lefebvre, I asked Patrick Lefebvre about the quick step setup, and very quickly drifted into something else, saying it's great that we have those races, the Grand Départ, outside of France. It's great that it shows the popularity of cycling to have all these fans, as we saw in Denmark for 3 days, that the excitement and everything. But he said, in the same time, it's very costly, and Lefebvre, in typical fashion, was all about how much it costs to run a cycling team and how the budget is tight and how he's nearly getting bankrupt because of the price of petrol going up, the crisis in Ukraine, COVID test, he said, worth a fortune. And I was really sorry, leaving Patrick, thinking, I mean, this guy is going to, he's miserable and his team have no money. And it's all because of COVID, the war in Ukraine, and the logistics of a transfer back to France.
Well, Francois, we have got an audience of two people sitting very, very close to us. While we talk to them, why don't you listen to Tom Southam from the EF Education Easy Post team, who was talking about the logistics for their team and staff getting their bus and all their vehicles back to France for the resumption of the race on Tuesday. All three of the Grand Tours this year have got these starts with an overseas Grand Départ and then a travel / rest day. Does the whole peloton tackle those logistics in exactly the same way, or are there some variations? What are you doing?
So for us, I mean, it's quite complicated. So we don't have like another fleet of vehicles, for example, that we can use. Like some teams will have a bus and a truck or whatever, that even if they don't come on the race, they're there for the rest day for the riders. So we have to get our vehicles there. Like we've staggered our exits. So our chef left last night with a soigneur. We've got like the trucks gone with the bikes, and so because the hardest thing is the riders are going to get there, they're going to turn up, they want to have like a meal, they want to like see the chiro, see the doctor if they've got injuries, all that sort of work. So we have to like move all of them, but then we also have to do the stage today, and with all the extra feeds you've got, you then have to get other people to do extra feeds, and then driving, you can't have one person alone doing, even after a stage, even 300Ks tonight, it's tiring, The DSs have been in the car all day, so you shouldn't really be driving. So then it's been quite a big operation for us. I mean, I spoke to some teams a little bit, but like I know DSM Westie said that they've got like a setup that's kind of that they can use there. I know Quickstep truck didn't leave in a rush this morning, but they're in Belgium. So I mean, when we had the TTT in Brussels, there were teams there that had two buses, one at the start and one at the finish, whereas we only had a finish van at the finish. So you have to, if you've got extra vehicles, obviously staff you have to move because of the bubble, but vehicle wise for someone to follow the training tomorrow, there has to be a car there, they have to have the bikes there, so getting all that there is quite a big operation.
When do the riders go? They're on a flight tonight, is that right?
Yeah, they fly tonight, which is, you know, it's pretty straightforward for them. And they'll fly with the doctor, 1DS and the Cairo, so we get those people in. And fingers crossed they don't get too late at night. And
do you know what time those flights are scheduled to go?
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, they could say come back, they're going to shower on the bus, get ready to go, and then I would think stage finish 5:30. I thought it was around 7 something, but I'm not sure. I mean, I've done it before when, because there's 4 planes on the runway, they also have to get clearance to take off, and then there's all the air traffic and that sort of stuff. So, I mean, they do it really well, the ASO, and it is, like, it feels like this year there's a lot, but if you remember, this was supposed to be 2020, so everything's jumbled around a little bit by COVID, you know, so. But quite a lot's gone into it, and everyone's going to be a little bit stretched today.
Did it affect the racing? Because obviously anyone who has a minor injury today can be treated on the move, but anyone who needs any kind of, you know, hospital treatment, that they might be, yeah, I know, touch wood. But it's an extra factor, isn't it? A rider, if the stage is just starting again tomorrow or there's just a regular rest day, no problem. But if you've also got to do a big transfer, can't hold up the whole plane for, you know, 1 or 2 riders.
No, exactly. So I mean, that's nobody wants that. Everybody's hoping that doesn't happen, but then we'll have to make a provision for that. I mean, there's enough vehicles here, and that rider will be, you know, if there's riders like that, they're going to be extremely unfortunate. There is like a, so there's an x-ray machine at the finish, which is a big help, because you can do that. The podium presentation has to happen, you know. If Magnus is still in the jersey, they've got to wait for him anyway, and so yeah, I mean, I think if you're unlucky enough to have to have gone to a hospital, then maybe your race is done anyway.
So the bus leaves tonight and we'll just get as far as legally and safely it can, because obviously the driver will be on the taco, I suppose.
Well, we've got 2 bus drivers, so we tried to get around it by bringing an extra bus driver. So it's like extra staff on teams. I mean, we're 34 here in total with the riders. Some teams are more, up to like 40s and stuff. Because, I mean, there used to be the 30 restriction in the COVID years, but that's gone, sort of semi-fortunately, because it was quite nice to work in when you had a nice round number, and it was easy. But, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I mean, teams have done it quite a bit, you know. They did Belfast, so you can imagine that, and that was, like, different vehicles. I know the Giro's given vehicles when they did Israel. It was all different vehicles there and stuff, so. But with your own vehicles, it gets it's quite tricky,
and it adds to the cost. Who picks up that cost? Is it ASO or the teams?
That's a question for someone above my level, I think, Lana. I'm not sure. I mean, we're all going to drive, you know, 1,000 kilometres, and it's going to cost whatever it costs these days. So it's going to be it's not cheap.
Well, we've regained our composure. Well, that was like having an audience of 2, wasn't it? They were sitting very, very close. They almost put Francois off the podcast there, our friends from Sonneborg. Mm. And they've also revealed that the Prime Minister of Denmark has been here in Sonneborg today. And Mitch, when we were talking to Kate, or when I was talking to Kate and we were walking back to the press room, we heard the sirens and we saw the blacked out limo type cars come flying past. Perhaps that was the Prime Minister there being given an escort back to, I guess, Copenhagen.
I think it was. It was like, you know, like you, it was an escort. It was just like sirens on, they were going like 100k an hour through the town. It's quite cool.
Well, it's been a really big deal here in Denmark this weekend. Just a few things to say before we wrap up. At Kilometre Zero, part 2 of Danish Dynamite will be out in the morning. The first part looked at the kind of the rise and fall of Danish cycling, and part 2 looks at the further fall and then the rebirth of Danish cycling. And I think we can probably agree that Denmark has done the Tour de France absolutely proud this weekend. It's been phenomenal with the crowds and the party atmosphere. A couple of other bits of business to mention. Stacey Snyder's mug sold out in just a few minutes on Friday. I forgot to mention that on Friday because we were recording on the hoof, but there will be another batch of her mugs for the Tour de France fam towards the end of the month, so look out for those. And, well, the logistics don't get any easier for us, do they? Because I've got to go back to Copenhagen, which is about 3 hours away, and then fly back to Gatwick, and then our colleague
Tom Carey from The Telegraph and I will cross the channel and hopefully we'll be reunited back in Lille tomorrow evening, ready to resume the race on Tuesday morning with the stage from Dunkirk to Calais. Now, just a last word. Francois, what have you made of Denmark?
It was great, actually. Too short. I mean, obviously, well, I should cover the Tour of Denmark. No, but I mean, the passion, the excitement. You could never feel any tension or any bad vibes, you know? The crowds were almost as, you know, huge as in Yorkshire, which remains, to me, the world record ever, you know, for a Grand Départ. But here, I mean, I'm not saying there were tensions in Yorkshire at all. That's not what I mean. But here, everybody was really friendly. The Magnus Cort, feeling and the way he behaved is not something personal, I think. You can tell it's also part of the Danish way of life and the Danish kind of strange kind of humor. So, yeah, it was a nice, really nice day. Good beers. Good food as well. Strange last night, but I mean, we won't get into that.
Well, I was going to mention just before we get to the Michelin guide about the hotel, because dinner was slightly odd, wasn't it? It was kind of lobster in a hot dog bun, followed by a kind of fillet of fish in breadcrumbs on toast. It was an odd... It was not unpleasant by any means. But Mitch, what about the hotel? The Michelin Guide. How many stars from the Michelin Guide for our hotel last night?
I give that one probably just about 3.5 last night. It was in a lovely location, right on the fjord, like you said. Beautiful spot. But it just, for me, it just felt like a bit of an old folks' home. Sorry. The heating was too hot. It was very carpeted everywhere, and the decor was just that little bit, and it was actually filled with old folks. But yes, the food, it wasn't, and you thought it was a lobster roll because that's what they were telling us, but actually it was a shrimp roll. Yeah.
Was it?
It was, because they kept saying lobster. And they presented this dish to us, and I fell for it too. The special dish, the mixture of fish, it was described as a plate full of all assortment of fish. This came out two pieces of crumb deep fried fish, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't unpleasant, but it was a bit eccentric, maybe. I don't know, but there we go. What are you going to get tonight? You're going to have the Tour de France press room buffet for dinner.
Yeah, we know what we're going to get because I mean, it's burgers from the press room. They look pretty nice actually. The burgers from the press room. We'll see what we get. And but that's the Tour de France. One day in a fancy Michelin star restaurant. The next, eating shrimp rolls. You know, in a whole folks' home. And the other day, you know, burgers in a press room. I mean, that's my stomach sometimes disagrees, but you know. That's the Tour de France.
That's the life of the journo, really, isn't it?
Well, we'll all meet up in Lille tomorrow evening. Safe travels, Mitch. Safe travels, Francois. We will sign off with the Tour de Buffalo. And I think Denmark has rivaled Yorkshire for the way that it has welcomed and enhanced the Tour de France. And this clip is from 2014, the Grand Départ in Yorkshire, when Richard Daniel and I spoke to Christian Prudhomme and he had his famous quote about humongous bunting that festooned Yorkshire. And we will end the show with a memory of Richard Moore.
The Tour du Buffalo, remembering Richard Moore.
Huge crowds, beautiful landscapes, passion for cycling, passion for a tour, French flags, British flags, yellow flags, bunting.
So we heard there from Christian Prudhomme, the director of the Tour de France, the Grand Fromage, no less. What didn't come across in that interview, in the audio version of the interview, was the hand gestures, which added so much to his very passionate dispatch on today's first stage of the tour here in Yorkshire. We should explain that Christian is Prudy, as we call him, is a friend of the podcast, and he was a special guest at the Cycling Writers of Great Britain Christmas dinner in London last year, and he was a great sport. He came along and agreed to dress up as Santa Claus, Father Christmas, and made a special entrance, Santa Claus with sunglasses. It was fantastic. He's a great character, isn't he, Daniel?
Fantastic sport, a very charismatic man, very good speaker, as we heard there.
Yeah, I thought he was actually quite emotional. I mean, he said it was an emotional day, and you could see it in his eyes. And I was trying to sort of imagine what it must be like to be the driving force behind creating all of this. You know, it is down to him. He had a personal hand in choosing Yorkshire. I know there was a kind of battle between Yorkshire and Edinburgh. I know you were a bit upset that Yorkshire got the nod initially, Richard. Well, wouldn't you have liked Edinburgh to have got it?
Not with the bid that they put in the end, which was rolling out of Edinburgh and heading south. I didn't fancy that so much as a prologue in Edinburgh, I think, would be spectacular. But the Yorkshire Grande part, I don't think anybody who supported the Scottish bid can have any complaints at all, because we should get on to talking about today's first stage. We will get Christian Prudhomme back on the podcast, I'm sure. I know he's very keen to appear on it as regularly as possible.
Daily, perhaps.
We'll be fighting him off.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
Why have I asked my HVAC guy I found on Angie.com to change my grandpa's trachea tube? Because I was so amazed by how quickly he replaced our air ducts. I knew I could trust him to change Pop-Pop's tube while I was on vacation.
Make it quick, young man.
Aw, see? Pop-Pop trusts you.
I think we should call a doctor.
Connecting homeowners with skilled pros for over 30 years. Angie, the one you trust to find the ones you trust. Find pros for all your home projects at Angie.com.
It's 10:01 a.m. on a Monday, all at once. Your sales leader needs to know which deals are at risk, your PM wants feature adoption by cohort, and your CFO needs one last graph for the board. Now your data team has to say no to somebody. Hex changes that. Ask any data question in plain English and get an analyst-grade response, all backed by your actual business context as defined by your data team. Start saying yes to more data questions at hex.ai.
Overtime, moss, mold, and mildew stains cover your home, and cleaning them is too much work. You need Wet and Forget, the easy bleach-free way to clean tough outdoor stains. For decks, patios, and cushions, use Wet and Forget outdoor spaces. No scrubbing, no rinsing. Just apply and let it do the work for you over time. Got a bigger job? Reach second-story siding and roofs with Outdoor Max. Up to a 30-foot reach and 2 times the coverage. Get Wet and Forget at Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart.